The Emergency Severity Index, or ESI, is a five-level triage system that is used in really almost all emergency departments in the U.S. While emergency nurses may have a strong command of the ESI algorithm, the rest of you listening who have been patients in the emergency department may have not realized that you were assigned a number from 1 to 5, a number reflecting both the severity of your condition and the level of resources for your care. 1 is the highest level, indicating a need for immediate life-saving interventions, with 5 as the lowest, given to patients who are non-urgent, who, for example, may need a simple med refill. Now, before you stop and say, "Hey, I'm not an emergency nurse. This podcast episode isn't for me," I am going to challenge you. What is one of the most core fundamental skills of a nurse? What does the NCLEX test over and over and over again? Prioritization. That's right. In our reality as nurses, we have multiple patients with very finite resources, and we must have the crucial ability to triage our own patients. This is the constant undercurrent that directs our attention throughout our 12-hour shifts. While non-emergency nurses may not use the ESI system, I would strongly argue that nurses who know how to triage are going to be even sharper at prioritizing their own patients' care in whatever department they work in. And you know what I love about ESI is that it goes beyond simply categorizing patients based on their likelihood of immediate death, but encompasses a more holistic approach that considers factors impacting patients' well-being and functionality. This broader perspective acknowledges that patients' needs extend beyond immediate life-threatening conditions and emphasizes the importance of factors that may significantly affect their quality of life and ability to function and do all the things that we value so dearly in life. To guide us through triage, I have for us today my friend Kevin McFarlane. Kevin has over 20 years of experience in the ED and is the host of not just one, but 2 emergency nursing podcasts. Throughout this episode, we'll dive deep into the Emergency Severity Index, exploring the 5 triage levels and the specific criteria used to assign each one. However, our discussion goes beyond just categorizing medical emergencies. You'll gain valuable insight into a more comprehensive approach to triage, one that accounts for psychological safety and quality of life impacts. Be sure to stay tuned till the end when we peek into the future and examine how artificial intelligence could revolutionize emergency triage protocols in the years ahead. Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school. Are you interested in sitting for the CCRN, PCCN, or cardiac medical or cardiac surgical exams? I passed the PCCN using Nicole Kupchick's on-demand video courses and book of practice questions. With over 25 years of critical care experience, Nicole will guide you through the exam content with a casual, engaging, and very memorable teaching style. She also has online courses that cover all sorts of other critical care topics, such as stroke review and hemodynamic monitoring boot camps. If you want to up your nursing career, check out Nicole Kupchick at NicoleKupchickConsulting.com and use the promo code UPMYGAME20 to get 20% off all of her products. The link is in the show notes.
Well, hi, my name's Kevin McFarland, and I am the host of a podcast called The Art of Emergency Nursing and the co-host of a podcast called How Not to Kill Your Patient. I've been in emergency nursing in the emergency department for about 20 years. I am a certified emergency nurse, certified trauma nurse. I have a bunch of certifications and recently became a fellow in the Academy of Emergency Nursing, which was a huge honor.
I don't know how else to say it, but Kevin is kind of a big deal in the emergency nursing world. I've had him on the podcast multiple times already to discuss all things emergency. So when I had a listener request to talk about the Emergency Severity Index, I knew exactly who to reach out to.
So ESI is kind of like a brand. So it's kind of like a particular flavor of what we call triage, right? And triage, I think, is a concept that emergency nurses feel very comfortable with, but not all nurses do. Triage, it comes from the French word to sort, and it's all about sorting your patients to make sure that the person who needs care the fastest, the most, is going to get that care first. So we're sorting out our patients so that we take care of our most severe and most critical patients first, and then the patients who are less severe are going to be seen maybe a little bit later. I always remind nurses outside of the emergency department is the most dangerous place in the entire hospital is the ER waiting room. Because in the ER waiting room, if they haven't been triaged yet, we may not know how severe or how sick they really are. So one of the most important things we need to do is very quickly, when they come into the emergency department, get them triaged, find out how severe they are, and then get them categorized accordingly.
What does triage look like? I mean, besides getting the patient's story for, you know, what brings you in today, are you getting vital signs? Are you drawing labs? Like, what goes on in that process?
So the first process for triage is really kind of getting the history. You're going to get the history from the patients. And one of the things that the new update of ESI triage, and we'll talk about how it was recently updated, that it really kind of focuses on is making sure that we're getting vital signs, making sure we're getting vital signs so we can see physiologically how is that patient doing. We're going to get a good history of what exactly brought them to the emergency department, what made them decide to seek out care. And then find out a little bit of their past medical history and see how that all kind of fits together to find out just how sick that person actually is.
So who's performing triage? Is it a nurse? Is there ever like a role for a technician or a physician in triage?
In all hospitals, nurses are going to be the ones who are doing the triage. Now, in hospitals, depending on how busy they are, and you know, the busy level one trauma center that I used to work at, we had a technician who was there in triage helping us get vital signs, helping us, you know, get the patients from one section to the next and help just kind of facilitating that triage process. And then we also had a mid-level provider who might be able to do a little bit more, who might be able to say, okay, well, let's go ahead and order these labs. Let's go ahead and order this bundle of care. But it varies by hospital. The hospital that I work in now, it's just one nurse triaging. They're doing all the job themselves and then getting as many patients through as we can. So it just kind of varies depending on how busy the organization is and the size of the organization.
I mean, why is ESI important? Why is it important to, you know, assign a definitive number to a patient?
Really, what it's really designed to do is it's designed to see who needs care first. So if you think about the typical hospital, if you're in a level one trauma center in an urban city, a waiting room at any one time can have 20, 30 people in the waiting room. And to find out from those 20 or 30 people, who is the most at risk and who are we worried about needing care immediately and who has the luxury of being able to wait. So we always joke that, you know, being worse makes you first. And really with triage, that's kind of the thing. It's, you know, the sickest people are going to get in and get seen the quickest. And then we could be able to really kind of stratify, okay, these people might be able to wait and these people can wait potentially a little bit longer. So it's all about providing the best care, the quickest care to as many people as possible.
It's essentially about assigning resources appropriately, right? Like,
correct. Yeah. Correct. Utilizing your resources, because every hospital, no matter how big they are, it has limited resources, right? We never have enough hospital rooms, enough hospital beds, enough nurses to take care for everybody. Very, very few hospitals have that luxury. So when that's the case, then we have to determine who's going to get seen first and who can wait.
So let's jump into it. Let's talk about the levels of care. So the levels go from 1 to 5. In my mind, as someone who has limited experience with ESI, level one is like circling the drain. Like the person is unstable, maybe actively dying in like a code situation. But in your words, what is a level one and what are the criteria for meeting it?
You're absolutely right. So level one, depending on where you are, what you are, you know, some people will call it an A, some people will call it a level one. We'll stick with level one just to make it easy. These are your people who need immediate intervention, immediate life-saving intervention. These are folks who need to be actively resuscitated. Now, these are people who are quite sick and need immediate intervention, whether it be medication or maybe it's a procedure. Maybe they need to be intubated quickly. Maybe they need to have a medication that's going to keep them from dying, whatever the case may be. But these are your people who need immediate care. So these are often people that in triage, we may not even get to the place where we're doing vital signs on them. We may be like, okay, this may be like an immediate recognition that we're going to go ahead and take back to a care area. So things like someone who needs to be intubated, things like people who experience a cardiac arrest, where they need CPR immediately, or they need defibrillation immediately. Maybe they need immediate with either medications or electricity or procedures. Those are going to be your ESI ones. These are people that we're not even, and oftentimes in triage, the ones aren't even going to get triage. We're not going to do the vital signs necessarily in triage. We're going to take them immediately back to a care area and get the care started there with the care team.
To me, the classic example is an active heart attack. And those are the patients for whom we see them clutching their chest and they're looking gray, and you immediately take them back and they're off to the cath lab within, 15 minutes.
I think a great example for like an ESI triage, for instance, maybe imagine somebody who's having a narcotic overdose, right? So someone's experiencing a narcotic overdose, they're not breathing. They have, they're found to have very pinpoint pupils. They have very slow respirations. They need to be actively resuscitated in order to maintain life, right? So that would be an example of somebody who would be a level one triage, because we need to actively intervene right now or this patient's not going to do well.
Would anaphylaxis be part of a ESI one?
Anaphylaxis is a great example, because anaphylaxis is my favorite disease, right? Like it's something trying to kill you in a lot of different ways. But anaphylaxis would be a great example of a disease that would be immediate intervention, like because we know how to fix that. We have the medications to fix anaphylaxis, but it needs to be acted on immediately. It's a great example.
Yeah. I like that. That's your favorite disease. It must be because it's very fixable. And I think, just going to throw this out there, being of the male gender, you like to fix things.
True. But if you think about anaphylaxis is the cool thing, because it's really your body trying to kill you, right? So your throat is tightening, your airway is closing. At the same time, your vasculature is opening, right? So you're having vasodilation, right? So your tank suddenly is bigger than it was, right? Your circulation system, you're going to vasodilate, your capillaries are going to open up, and that's where you get that urticaria, right? And you have vasodilation, you have bronchoconstriction, and your body's just really trying to like fight whatever that antigen was, and in the meantime it doesn't realize it's trying to kill you too. It's the coolest disease.
It's the coolest.
And the nice and the nice thing is it's super fixable, right? Like we give them some epi and bam, you know, the vasodilation is going to get better, the bronchoconstriction is going to get better. Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, it's super cool when you see true anaphylaxis, which when you really see anaphylaxis, it's one, it's scary. Two, if you've ever seen somebody who needs, you know, these are sometimes you'll see people who have anaphylaxis have the little EpiPens, because again, it's an immediate need, and that EpiPen certainly can reverse all that stuff.
Yeah. I've never seen it. Personally, I've seen some pretty severe, scary reactions, but like a true systemic anaphylaxis.
I got to tell you, I think it's not super common. Like, everyone thinks that like it happens all the time, and thank God it's not. I think I've seen probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 cases of true anaphylaxis where I was like, they need the epi and they need it now.
What about seizures? Are they going to at all like an active tonic-clonic seizure?
If they're having an active seizure and they need immediate interventions for medications, yeah, that could be an ESI, that could be an ESI 1 type of an emergency if they need immediate intervention. Because if you think about seizures, unless we get benzos, sometimes, and you know, the nice thing about seizures is oftentimes they're self-limiting. But if it's not self-limiting, if they're, you know, in that, you know, status epilepticus, for instance, where they need medication to actually break that seizure, that could very well be an ESI-1 patient.
Okay, cool. So it sounds like ESI-1 is going to be your respiratory arrest, narcotic overdose, your active MIs, your anaphylaxis, for ones for whom you need to intervene now to save a life.
Absolutely. And things like hypoglycemia could be potentially an ESI-1, even though it's a quick fix, they do need immediate intervention. So, and that's one of the things that they recently updated ESI, and they included all those things in that ESI-1. And ESI-1, it used to be, you know, are they, you know, do they need to be shocked? Do they need to be intubated? Do they, you know, are they actively dying? But realizing that time-sensitive emergency, even like hypoglycemia, which is, you know, if we know the cause, then we know the fix. But that does require an immediate intervention. That would still be a good example of an ESI-1. One of the changes they recently made in the ESI is don't focus on the trajectory. Don't focus on like the long term, but focus on the immediate need. What is the immediate need? And if the immediate need is high and immediate, that's a level 1. Even though it might be something that, you know, for instance, hypoglycemia, if someone comes in and they have hypoglycemia, that may very well be an ESI-1 because there is immediate need. Now, that person still may very well get discharged, but if we don't intervene immediately, then they could die. And that's one of the things that the new ESI algorithm is kind of focused on, is don't focus on the trajectory, focus on the right now.
Got it. That's really interesting. So this actually shifts things in my mind a little bit from, it's not necessarily the number of resources, it's the timeliness of the resource.
Yeah, we'll talk about resources as we get into the lower levels of triage, because then resources become really, really important. But and they are important, but what we're looking at is the timeliness is really the focus of ESI-1.
Okay. That's a really good point to make. And that is definitely like a frame shift for me. Okay. So we talked about ESI-1s. Moving on to ESI level of 2.
Okay. So once you get past that, whether or not this is a high risk situation or something where like a life or death situation with immediate need, the next kind of decision point is whether or not this is what we consider a high risk situation. So those are your ESI-2s. These are your people who are very sick. They may not need immediate intervention, but they do need intervention. So these are going to be your people who have the potential to deteriorate somewhat quickly and have a high acuity. You know, there's like a high acuity in whatever change is going on. These are patients who are in severe pain, who are in severe distress, either psychologically or physically. Those all fit in that triage 2 category.
Got it. Maybe their vitals are stable now, but there's a high chance that they'll quickly become unstable.
Yeah. So this might be like your active chest pain that we're suspicious for a coronary syndrome. This might be your patient who's a stroke, for instance, who may need immediate intervention for the stroke, like a clot busting drug. Someone who needs the intervention pretty quickly. This could be somebody like a sepsis patient. Sepsis patients are kind of classic level twos where they're very sick, and though they may not be actively needing resuscitation right now, if we don't intervene, they're soon going to get to that spot. So those are those kind of level two patients. These, you know, things like sepsis, stroke, cardiovascular. But also one of the things that we talk about when we talk about level twos is their psychological safety. Like, are they at risk for wanting to hurt themselves? Like, are they an immediate risk to themselves? A suicidal patient is always a level two, right? Because they need immediate intervention. If they didn't have that, they might hurt themselves. So that's kind of your next level once you get past the immediate resuscitation piece.
How does pregnancy influence any of these?
Pregnancy is kind of one of those funny things that, you know, it could very well need immediate interventions, but oftentimes these patients aren't going to be cared for in the emergency department. These are patients who are going to be shipped off to labor and delivery pretty quickly. Like, if you want to scare an ER nurse, give them a pregnant patient who's about to deliver. They're going to want it's like the emergency nurse kryptonite, right? We're going to want to get them off to labor and delivery just as quickly as we can. We try our best not to deliver patients in the emergency department.
I remember when I was a nursing student and I was completing my last semester in an emergency department, I saw a patient come in for suicidal ideation, and he was assigned an ESI of 5. And I went to my preceptor, and I intuitively, like, I was proud of myself. Like, I was like, Joel, is that right? Should that really be a 5? And he got up so fast, walked over to triage, and the next thing I knew, that patient was a 2. And yeah, so it's one of those, like, their vitals are okay, probably, but we need to, you know, think about their safety.
Absolutely. And when you said they were a triage 5, the audience didn't see this, but my eyes got really big, like, what? Huh? I had probably the same reaction your preceptor had, because the reality is those guys are at high risk, those suicidal patients. And suicidal patients are ones that I think a lot of nurses have a little bit of a hard time with, because when we say suicidal, it could be anywhere from, you know, somebody who's actively trying to take their own lives to somebody who is, you know, this is kind of a cry for help and a pretty minor suicide. Mm-hmm. But the reality is we don't know. We can't secure their safety until we truly secure their safety. That's why they're always going to be a level two.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an important one to point out. I think as nurses, we tend to focus on the medical side of things, but yeah, we do have to take into account the
psychological safety.
Psychological safety is a
great thing to keep in mind for not only is it their physiologic safety, but their psychological safety as well.
When I was in fast track as a nurse who was floating over to the emergency department, I remember getting in a patient with eye pain, and he went to the eye room. We had a specific eye room, which was in fast track. Sorry, it wasn't fast track. It was a little more acute than fast track, but it was like a low acuity area. So I was so surprised to see that they would send an ESI 2 to this less acute area of the emergency department. And when I questioned this, they said, well, we're talking about someone losing their vision. And that surprised me, because kind of going back to this thought that, well, his vital signs are stable, he's not going to imminently die. It is an utmost emergency to lose one of your senses.
100%. And eyes are one of those things that are a little bit weird, and that they can appear very vitally stable, but they could have a potentially life-changing event.
Oh, and, absolutely.
I mean, losing your sight would be life-changing, right?
Oh, your life.
So yeah, certainly. So those are ones that would be a high triage category, but potentially, depending on how the department is set up, might be able to be seen in a lesser acuity area, because again, the immediate intervention they may need is, you know, an ophthalmologist who's going to come down and see them, and oftentimes they bring their own toys. But the reality is, you know, they need a place in the department so that we can kind of get things started for them. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me to see a high acuity in a low acuity area just based on that kind of complaint. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Are there any other kind of unexpected ESI-2s?
One of the ones that the new ESI update particularly mentions that I think is an important thing is healthcare workers who have had a needle exposure, a blood exposure. Not something that, you know, typically, you know, you have, you know, Joe coming down from the fifth floor and he says, oh, geez, I had a needle stick. And, you know, he's just more pissed off that it happened in reality and, you know, and looks fine. But he still very well may be a triage too, because of the time sensitive nature of making sure that we are doing kind of prophylactic treatment just as quickly as possible. So that's one that often gets kind of triaged as kind of a lower category when reality should be probably a little higher.
Any other curveball twos?
No, not that I can think of.
Okay. So chest pain, strokes.
Yeah.
Suicidal ideation.
Anyone who's confused, lethargic, disoriented, new onset confusion, new onset lethargy, disorientation, you know, all those kinds of things would be that potential high risk situation.
Okay, sepsis. Yeah.
Sepsis would be a big one.
Cool. So let's talk about level 3. What are some of the criteria for level 3?
So the criterion for level 3 is basically if you're not a level 1, you're not a level 2, then we need to figure out if you're a 3, 4, or 5, right? So we're going to kind of talk about those kind of all together. And a lot of the patients that come into the emergency department fall into that, probably that 3 category, where they need some stuff, but they may not need it right the second, right? It's not a time-sensitive emergency. And always telling patients that is always kind of a hard thing, where you're like, okay, I know you're sick, and I know you don't feel good, and you need some stuff, but you're not dying right now. You're doing okay. So those 3, 4s, and 5s, that's when we start talking about resources. How many resources are they going to need? Are they going to need no resources? Then they're going to be a level 5. If they're going to need just one resource, then they're going to be a level 4. And then if they're going to need many resources, that's going to be a level 3. So you're putting on your fortune-telling hat in the emergency department and kind of guessing how many resources are those people actually going to need. So things that would be resources, are they going to need labs? Are they going to need blood? Are they going to need urine? And that's almost everybody in the emergency department, right? We're going to try to get some blood. We're going to try to get some urine to help kind of figure out physiologically what's going on with them. Are they going to need any kind of imaging, x-rays, ultrasounds, CTs? Those things are all resources, right? They're going to need a CT and an MRI. That's, you know, that's 2 separate resources. Are they going to need intravenous fluids? That's a resource. Things like medications, intramuscular medications, any kind of medications that they're going to be given, those are resources. So for instance, your patient who comes in with an asthma attack, they very well may need, you know, IM, you know, maybe they're going to need like an IM steroid or IV, you know, IV steroids, but they're also going to need a nebulized medication. That's another resource. And then are they going to need any kind of specialty consultations? If they're going to need any specialty consultations, again, they're going to fall in that 3 category. 3 is your typically going to be your broadest bucket. Like, so when I look at the board in our emergency department, I see, you know, maybe 1 or 2 1s, maybe 1 or 2 2s, and then I'm going to see a whole lot of 3s, right? 3s are going to be your most common ED patient. Now, your 4s and 5s, depending on your hospital system, those may be people that we either refer to urgent care if there's an urgent care on site, or they may be like what you mentioned earlier, like a fast track care area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in my experience, you know, talking about resources, like the ESI-3s can be heavy on the resources. So 100%. In my mind, like a classic ESI 3 will be abdominal pain. And that is like the black hole of an emergency department is getting in an abdominal pain patient, because they're probably going to need an IV. They might need fluid resuscitation. They might need antibiotics. They will need to go to ultrasound, CT. And like the diagnosis is not often very obvious. So it all makes sense now to me when you explain that ESI 1 and 2 is more an assignment based on immediacy than that 3 and 5 then are about resources.
Yep. And that's exactly what it is. An abdominal pain, like you mentioned, is the classic example of an ESI 3 because, you know, they're likely to get IV meds, they're likely to get CT'd, x-rayed, they're going to get labs. I mean, they're going to use many, many resources to figure out what exactly is going on with them. Now they very well may be sick. They very well may be sick. And don't think that your threes aren't sick. Your threes are kind of like bread and butter ED cases, right? Like they're, you know, your an appendicitis, for instance, very well may be, you know, where they very well may need a surgical intervention. That's probably going to be an ESI 3.
What about the instance when abdominal pain means something very life-threatening? Like, I don't know if this – would you ever change the ESI rating based on what's found in diagnostics?
That is such a great question, because once the care has started, ESI is basically how soon do we need to get them to see a provider? Once the provider is seen and once that care is started, ESI doesn't matter. So typically, you're not going to go back and change an ESI triage category most of the time. Now, where you might change the category is if they have not seen a provider yet. So if, for instance, they're in triage, you're doing a triage, you're kind of working them up for abdominal pain, and then suddenly it's realized that they are indeed an ectopic pregnancy, or there's, you know, the thought that it is an ectopic pregnancy, then that very well may be an ectopic pregnancy, very well could be a level 2. That could be life-threatening. It's a good example of one of those things that kind of fly under the radar, but could be life-threatening.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the charge nurse kind of hammered into our heads, a woman of childbearing years plus abdominal pain is ectopic pregnancy until ruled otherwise.
Oftentimes I'll say a woman of childbearing years is pregnant until proven otherwise, yeah. Right? Like trust all, but get the pregnancy test, right? Like, and we used to see that in both in peds too. You know, peds, we would, as young as 12 years old, we're getting a pregnancy test. Like, it's just part of the workup. If they come in with abdominal pain, they're going to get a pregnancy test. And we'd often ask, hey, is there any chance you could be pregnant? And the answer is always no, right? Like, there's always like, no chance, no way. And then, you know, you're still going to get a pregnancy test.
That could be a podcast episode in and of itself. Patients who find out they're pregnant and, you know, you hear stories all the time.
All the time. So, you know, I always laughed when I'd hear, you know, someone say, oh, well, she didn't even know she was pregnant. You're like, how did she not know she's pregnant? But it happens all the time. I've had women give birth and they're like, I didn't know I was pregnant. And they're like not unsmart women, right? Like these are not like clueless women. These are like normal, you know, women who are like just maybe had no clue.
Yeah, I've heard of this before, but I don't know. It's really, really hard for me to understand because I definitely knew I was pregnant when I was pregnant.
So I have a friend who was pregnant and I didn't know she was pregnant until she was very pregnant. Like she was kind of a bigger gal. And just wore it well. Like, I mean, if you are pregnant, you are clearly going to be visibly pregnant, right? But someone who's kind of big anyway, it could be easily missed.
Yeah.
Like it could happen.
It could. So it could. What are some other examples of an ESI 3? So we talked about kind of classic abdominal pain. What are some other ones?
Headaches very well may be an ESI 3 if we've ruled out that, if they're not having the worst headache of their life, for instance, when someone says this is the worst headache of my life, or even if they have a history of migraines and they say this is 100 times worse than my normal migraine, that might recommend a higher level, a higher level acuity. But for the most part, like a lot of times, your person who comes in with a migraine, your person who comes in with a headache might be an ESI either 3 or 4, depending on the situation. Or, one of the things that we really kind of focus on is in that determination of the 3s, the 4s, and the 5s, one of the things we have to look at is we have to look at their vital signs. We have to look at the vital signs and are there vital signs outside of what we would consider the normal? If so, then that may get them bumped up to the next level, right? So if they're there and they have that, classic case headache, but they're also tachycardic, they're also tachypneic, things like that may end up getting them bumped up a level in triage.
Would you say that's being captured more now with the latest guidelines?
The latest guidelines have really kind of emphasized, here's a perfect example. When I was an ER manager, I went out and I watched the person who is our triage expert triage. And I went out there and I watched her triage, and she was bringing patients in. She was getting a history. She was writing a couple things down, and then she was sending them out to the waiting room. And I was like, wait, you haven't even done vital signs on these patients. And she was like, well, the ESI guidelines don't require that you do vital signs. And in the old guidelines, it would say consider vital signs. Well, a lot of people took that to mean consider taking vital signs. But really what I think they meant, and then this is me giving them the benefit of the doubt, I think what they really meant was consider the vital signs in your triage acuity, not consider doing them. You have to get the vital signs. And the new fifth edition of ESI really emphasizes this. You got to get the vital signs. You have to do them. And you have to consider whether or not these are high-risk vital signs. Are they tachypneic? Are they tachycardic? Are they hypotensive? Those are all things we have to consider when we are determining a triage category and exactly how sick those people are.
It seems like a needed clarification.
It was probably the thing I was the most excited about with this update, was they really kind of focused on, hey, like look at the vital signs and physiologically look at what is going on with your patient. Because I think oftentimes people kind of discount that, and that's critical. Because emergency nurses think that they have like this sixth sense that says, oh, I can tell if somebody's sick or not. Well, you might, but if you can't verify that with vital signs, then you're just guessing.
So we'll quickly move down to fours and fives here. So let's talk about some classic fours. So you said only one resource is expected for this kind of patient. Correct. So what are some like classic level fours?
So level four might be somebody who, gosh, let me think.
I was going to say, what about like a possible fracture, like toe pain, arm pain?
Yeah, I mean, if the one thing you're going to need, if the one thing you're going to need is an x-ray, for instance, that would be a good example of a level four, because they're going to come in, they're going to need an x-ray to determine what exactly, what the extent of the injury is. That's a great example, classic example of an ESI four. Again, depending on whether or not you're going to need any resources or not. I think as important as it is about talking about resources, it's also important to talk about what's not a resource. And this might be a good time to do that, is things that aren't considered resources, because you're going to do them on every single patient. Like getting a history and physical exam on every patient is just what you're going to do. That's not a resource, right? If they're going to get, just a saline lock or a heparin lock, like just a IV access as we're drawing the blood, for instance, that's not necessarily going to be a resource. If they're going to need oral medications, that's not necessarily going to be a resource. And then like simple wound care, like a good example for a 4 or 5 kind of triage level might be wound care, for instance. Like if someone comes in with a simple laceration where we're not going to need much. If all they're going to need, the only intervention they're going to need is the wound care and the tetanus shot, that's not a resource-heavy patient, right? That might very well be a 4 or could even be a 5. So I know we're kind of talking about these kind of all together, but you almost have to on the fours and fives because sometimes they can be pretty close.
Yeah, sure sounds like it.
The reality is like the ESI triage system is kind of an amazing tool in that it really kind of quantifies, okay, how many resources they're going to need, then they're going to be probably this level. Now, things change. You know, people are dynamic, right? Like you can come in and they seem like a straightforward ESI 3, and then all of a sudden they have some kind of event that makes them, you know, like, wow, okay, now they're really sick. And that isn't necessarily someone you would change their triage category, but you know, if they're already seeing a provider, you're just going to do what you need to do.
Yeah, maybe move them to a, you know, higher acuity area of the emergency department, but not necessarily like touch their ESI number.
Yeah, that ESI is just for the initial sorting of when they come into the emergency department.
It's like the sorting hat in Harry Potter.
If we only had that in triage, we could just put the sorting hat on you and say, you're a two. Go on. Boy, that'd be amazing, right? Like either that or we need those little scanners they have in like Star Trek. We're like, okay, this is what's going on with you.
Maybe next time not there yet. To ask, like, is there any area for AI in triage in the future?
Oh, that's a good question. So there are companies that are using kind of an AI algorithm, I guess you would say, for triage. But there's a company that they have a product that basically kind of sits in the background of the medical record. And some of the medical records are doing this now too, where it's going to look at those vital signs. And then it's going to say, okay, you've triaged this person as a category 3. Maybe consider making them a 2 based on this and saying, you know, based on this high heart rate, based on this low blood pressure, they might be maybe someone you would consider putting, you know, upping a level in triage. There's a company that's doing that now and it's being built into some of the things like Epic, and Cerner is trying to have that basically looking at those vital signs and saying, hey, based on this, maybe consider. I think nurses are really good at, unfortunately, ignoring data. Blowing through the data and just kind of thinking, you know, relying more on their gut. When if they rely more on that objective information, that's going to be more predictive of what your patient's ultimate outcome will be. I mean, I think that the more information you can get, because what we know for sure is we know patients are poor historians, right? Like patients can be very poor historians. I always use the example of my brother. My brother called me up one time and said, hey, I'm having this chest pain, really don't feel good. I got this kind of pressure in my chest, kind of going into my arm. And I'm like, dude, you're having a heart attack. Go to the hospital. He's like, I don't think I'm having a heart attack. I think I'm fine. And finally, I asked his wife, I'm like, how does he look? She goes, oh, he looks pale. He's sweaty. I'm like, oh, Jesus, go to the hospital. He's calling me to ask for advice, right? So finally he goes to the hospital and he called me up later. And he goes, well, I told you that I wasn't having a heart attack. I go, yeah, what did they tell you? They said, it's an acute MI. Okay. Glad it's not that heart attack. That would be bad.
Yeah.
And then fast forward, I don't know, 6 months, 8 months, a year, whatever it was, he was being triaged in my emergency department where I worked. And I just happened to be there because he asked me to be there as they were kind of triaging him. And they were asking him, do you have any medical history? And he's like, nope.
Oh, yeah.
No medical history at all. No, I'm good. And I'm like, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? And they're like, I have that stuff. Patients are really poor historians. If we have AI, if we have that AI concept that can look through previous visits,
yes,
and kind of comb through and say, hey, even though they're telling you they may not have a diagnosis of this, they had this. This is something that was diagnosed a year ago, 2 years ago, and they may not even know. They may not even know about it.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of potential for AI in healthcare. Like I'm excited to see what the future holds.
I know A couple of Stanford professors recently came out with a paper about the role of AI in writing history and physicals. And I think like that's a great opportunity for AI because, I mean, history, that could be very extensive for patients. And, you know, you got hospital doctors, you know, are so time strapped that I think that could be a great application for coming up with a history.
Imagine if when you open the patient's chart, you had like a true history based on, you know, their 20 last ER visits, you know, they've had these things. And now you see this already in a lot of medical records where they show previous diagnoses that may or may not still be pertinent to what you're talking about. But imagine if it kind of put this together and said, hey, this patient in their last three visits ended up becoming hypotensive and ended up in the ICU, having something that could flag those charts and say, hey, the last time the patient was here, they clinically deteriorated pretty quickly. That might put them in a higher category. That might help, you know, make you a little bit more suspicious of the potential.
Yeah. Oh, this is really interesting.
I think the future is exciting.
If we're still podcasting in 5 years, maybe we could come revisit ESI and see how much of it is being automated by
100%.
AI.
100%. I can't imagine AI is not going to become a bigger deal. I mean, I don't think it's ever going to replace, you know, a good history and physical and a physician, a well-trained physician. But imagine how much information that physicians are expected to just keep at the tip of their tongue or at the top of their brain. And it's just not as possible as it would be with AI.
Totally. So. Well, this is a great discussion. And I love the twist at the end to, you know, talking about how AI is going to influence triage in the future. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think the ESI 10th edition may look very, very different than what we're dealing with now. I think that the future is bright.
All right. Thank you so much for joining today, Kevin. I appreciate you sharing your time.
Oh, thanks for having me on the podcast. It's always great to hang out and talk to you.
All right. Thank you for listening. If you want to catch more of what Kevin is doing, check out his podcasts, The Art of Emergency Nursing, as well as How Not to Kill Your Patient, which he co-hosts with Dr. Lisa Wolf. If you've made it this far into the episode, I can only assume you found value in our discussion. I'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to leave a 5-star rating or review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Podcasts don't really go viral, so it's really word of mouth that keeps shows like this going. Your ratings and reviews go a long way to make sure that I can continue to provide high-quality content for you. Until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.